From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Michigan doctor talks about his own experience on a ventilator in treatment for COVID-19.
I actually asked to be intubated. I knew that it would help me with my breathing. I knew that it would allow me to rest or my body to rest and fight better, but I had no idea that it would get this bad.
Also, a water quality initiative that has a coalition of farmers and environmental groups cheering.
It was supposed to be a 10-year plan to pump about $900 million into a program that kept Lake Erie clean.
But sing along, you know the chorus. The pandemic has thrown it into chaos. We will check in also with one Michigan Weekly paper on the ropes, fighting back with stories of hope.
If they go away, you know, it leaves just an indecent hole in our news ecosystem.
All that and more coming at you later in the hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, one of Michigan's weekly papers faces down the extinction event for small presses, armed with hope.
Detroit has a lot to say to the rest of the country about what's going on because we've had to look for the hope in this kind of grimness for so long.
But first, we want to introduce you to a doctor who has a very personal story to tell about COVID-19. In mid-March, Eugene Vovchuk was going about his work as an anesthesiologist at Detroit Medical Center's Harper University Hospital. He's 38 years old. He'd heard about the virus, of course. He hadn't seen any cases yet. And he was not prepared for his own ordeal, including nearly a month in the hospital and weeks on a ventilator. Dr. Vovchuk, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, first of all, how you're doing right now? You're a couple weeks out from having been discharged, but obviously this isn't something you get better from overnight.
So I'm getting stronger and better every day, but I'm still very weak. I get winded very easily, so low endurance. I lost a lot of muscle mass laying in the hospital for over 2.5 weeks. And picking up my children, who are 1 and 3 and weigh less than 30 pounds, is an extreme task. I get physical therapy 3 times a week, and the exercises we're doing are with 5-pound weights, and to me, they feel like 30, 40-pound weights, 50-pound weights.
Before you got sick, were you working with patients who were showing symptoms from COVID-19?
So before I got sick, the weeks leading up to it, I was taking care of some sick patients. At that time, Harper Hospital, which is where I work, was not doing any sort of testing. And I think the week I got sick was the week that it was announced that there was a first diagnosed case in Michigan. So it was pretty early on. No one was really doing heavy testing.
If I remember correctly, it was hard to get a hold of testing materials, wasn't it?
Right, initially, I believe so, yes.
What was it like being a patient yourself?
It was humbling. It was at times difficult, just in terms of being inpatient. In my profession, I'm used to having things done right away, and that's not really how it works, being a patient. So it was definitely humbling and definitely a different experience than being on the other side, taking care of patients.
Will you tell us a little bit about your symptoms? I understand at first you thought it was influenza. Was it just sort of a standard package of fever and aches and coughing?
So I didn't think it was influenza. I thought it was maybe food poisoning. I had a lot of GI problems. Nausea, diarrhea, and high fevers were my symptoms for the first 9 days, 9 to 10 days. That's why I thought maybe it wasn't COVID-19. It was something else. I did get tested right away. So on Friday, March 13th, I had a fever of 103.4. And earlier that evening, I saw in the news that Beaumont Hospital was doing drive-through testing. And they were kind of the only ones in the area that were doing any sort of testing. So I drove there, got tested, and called in to work saying that I'm not going to be coming in next week.
Right.
And even though the hospital said it would take 24 hours, 24 to 48 hours for the test results to come back, it took 9 days for the test results to come back, and I was negative. But, you know, I was feeling awful and had high fevers that weren't relieved by Tylenol. And I was taking Tylenol around the clock every 6 hours and taking my temperature around the clock, and the fevers just wouldn't go down.
I think this is something that a lot of people are curious about. We know that some of the tests for the virus sometimes offer false negatives. What happens when you do get a negative test result, but you're still sick enough that you think you're going to need care? How did you go from one point to the other?
So actually, 2 days before I received my negative test result, I went back to Beaumont, and instead of doing the drive-through, I went into the ER because they had, at that time, they had a rapid test that would come back in, I believe, like 4 to 6 hours. So hoping I would be able to get that test. Unfortunately, that test was only set aside for really sick patients, kind of on ventilators. And so I was not able to get that test. I had other blood work done. I had a chest x-ray done. Everything was normal. So they sent me home. So it was difficult to try to get a second test done.
Do you know what finally turned the tide on that for you?
Well, I believe I got tested at Harper Hospital again when I got admitted. And then when I got transferred to University of Michigan, I definitely got tested there. And that's where I know of that I had a positive test or a positive result for the COVID-19. And then prior to leaving the hospital, I had a few more tests to make sure that I was virus-free.
Given that you had such a high fever, I was wondering how much of your hospitalization you actually remember.
Not a lot. And it's a lot of it isn't due to my high fever. A lot of it is that on my admission to Harper Hospital, they took another chest x-ray and told me you're developing pneumonia. And from then on, it progressed very quickly with just a shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, me requiring higher and higher levels of oxygen, and eventually being intubated, placed on a ventilator. And at that point, even the reason I got transferred to University of Michigan is there was concern that I might need ECMO, which is a heart and lung bypass system that is commonly used as a temporary measure while you treat the underlying disease. The program is not completely set up at Harper Hospital. That's why I was transferred to University of Michigan. And luckily, I did not need ECMO, and I was able to just stay on the ventilator. But being on the ventilator, I was heavily sedated. At times, I was paralyzed to help the ventilator do its job and provide, you know, oxygenation to my vital organs.
When you were transferred to the University of Michigan, I read that you were one of the first patients in a special kind of isolation unit. You told us a little bit about some of the treatments you took, but can you tell me about what doctors did for you there and how it helped?
Sure. So the unit is called RICU, R-I-C-U. It's a respiratory infectious care unit. It was set up in the Mott Hospital, actually. I think one of the floors of the Mott Hospital. And every room is a negative pressure room, meaning that when you open the door, nothing can exit the room. It's all kind of sucked into the room. So any sort of virus, any sort of dust particles, anything stays in that room. All isolation rooms are designed that way. And this unit was all just isolation rooms. So the treatment regime was and I know it well because I've taken care of not specifically COVID patients, but patients with ARDS or acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is what I ended up having because of COVID-19. And so basically, you're placed on a ventilator, you're heavily sedated. If that doesn't help with providing sufficient oxygen to your vital organs, then you escalate the ventilator, meaning you go up on the concentration of oxygen, and you tweak the settings, tweak the pressures that the ventilator is providing to inflate and deflate your lungs. If all of those measures don't work, then you paralyze the patient. So commonly in the operating room, we provide muscle relaxants or paralytic medicines that paralyze all your muscles. And that helps the ventilator do its job better. If that doesn't work, then you prone the patient, meaning you flip them onto their belly for a period of time. And that helps with oxygen as well. And then in the meantime, the main treatment is to get as much fluid off the lungs and diurese the patient as much as possible to help with oxygen exchange. And that's what they did to me.
We know that some hospitals have tried different kinds of prescription treatments for the symptoms or the conditions associated with COVID-19, hydrochloroquine, ketamine. Do you know much about the drugs that you were given in the hospital?
So the hydrochloroquine and azithromycin, I heard about it while I was still at home. And I have a friend who's a pharmacist and was able to find a pharmacy about 45 minutes away from my house that had the hydrochloroquine. And so I had another colleague of mine call in a prescription for me. So I started that medication while I was home. It was continued while I was in the hospital, I think for a total of 10 days. I don't know if that helped or not. Then while at University of Michigan, I was enrolled in a experimental study. So I don't know if I was given a placebo or the actual medication. The trial is ongoing. So those are kind of the two medicines that I was given. Otherwise, I was given antibiotics for pneumonia and just treated as if I had acute respiratory distress syndrome, as if I had other diseases, not specifically COVID-19.
Did you think that things were going to get as bad as they did?
No, I really didn't. I actually asked to be intubated. I knew that it would help me with my breathing. I knew that it would allow me to rest or my body to rest and fight better. But I had no idea that it would get this bad.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Eugene Vovchuk, who recently came out of a lengthy hospitalization for COVID-19. We'll hear what was going on at home while he was intubated after the break. Sit tight. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. My guest today is Dr. Eugene Vovchuk, an anesthesiologist with DMC Harper, who was hospitalized for nearly a month with COVID-19. Most of that time, he was unconscious and on a ventilator. Dr. Vovchuk is married with two kids under age 4, and I asked him how his family was doing during his confinement.
Oh, they were devastated. My wife learned a lot of medicine very quickly. You know, she had to call physicians daily, or actually at certain points she was getting hourly updates on how I was doing from both nurses and physicians. So she was very strong, and it was extremely stressful for her because she had to take care of two small children on top of being quarantined, on top of me being gravely ill.
I imagine that there was no way for them to visit you in the hospital.
No, the hospitals were closed to more or less kind of essential employees only. All the hospitals in the state and still are closed to visitors.
What was it like to see your wife and kids again after you started coming out of it?
It was, you know, incredible. Once I was with it mentally, you know, I started realizing what had happened and how lucky I was to survive. And I still do feel that, you know, I'm either like reborn or I have a second chance at life. It was just a very awe-inspiring kind of feeling to see them again and to realize what I've been through.
Were there moments when you were being treated when you thought that you might not make it?
No. So during my the period where I was the sickest, I was completely out of it and had no clue what was happening. Then immediately after that, I had delirium, and I was also out of it for, I don't know, maybe a week or so. And this was just, it commonly happens in patients who are in intensive care units when they lack sleep and are constantly awake. They start getting delirious, and there's auditory hallucinations, visual hallucinations. You know, people look different. You start seeing things, believing different things. And unfortunately, I had that. And I say unfortunately because it delirium by itself carries an increased mortality rate in patients. That's why it's watched out for. It's checked daily, if not more frequently, in high-risk patients and treated aggressively as soon as it's identified.
Wait, is it that the people who do experience delirium are at a higher risk for dying, or there's something about the delirium that makes it less likely that they'll survive?
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not up to date on the literature, but I know that it's an independent risk factor, so it has nothing to do with the disease, but they have a higher risk of mortality, but it's independent to disease process. It's like a secondary disease.
Eugene, you're in such an unusual position given that you've got this front row seat on medicine through your job, and at the same time you've experienced something that a growing number of Americans are dealing with, and that's having had COVID-19. Do you have any different view of the reaction to the pandemic in terms of the seriousness of it and the timelines that are put on us for physical distancing because of the experience that you had in the hospital?
Oh, absolutely. I know a lot of people are protesting the extension of staying at home and being quarantined. Me, on the other hand, I'm all for it. You know, this is a very serious disease. You know, a lot of people, because they've been either asymptomatic carriers or they had a mild form of the disease, think that everyone had the same experience. But, you know, me being steps away from dying because of this disease, I'm definitely going to be a lot more conservative. And I feel everyone should be more conservative in terms of social distancing and being quarantined and, you know, washing their hands and doing all those things, wearing masks.
What does getting back to normal look like for you? I wonder if, given the extensive recovery period that a lot of COVID patients have to go through, what's your timeline? Are you thinking you'll be back to work by the end of the year?
Probably by December, for sure. So towards the end of my hospital stay, I had daily physical therapy, and I got to talk to a lot of physical therapists, and they said that for every week that I'm in the hospital or kind of bedbound, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to recover strength. So given the fact that I was hospitalized almost 3 weeks, I'd say 3 to 4 months is what I would need with intensive physical therapy to kind of get back to where I was prior to being hospitalized.
How does that feel to hear that?
I mean, it feels good that I'll be able to recover. However, it's a long process, and you know, I need to realize that I can't rush it. It has to take its time. You know, there are certain things like I couldn't open a bottle of water the other day. I had to ask my wife to do that.
The smallest things.
Right. And, you know, before she would ask me to, you know, open a can of pickles or whatever. So it's definitely humbling, and it feels weird to be this weak.
Is there anything that you're doing differently in your day-to-day life now, other than the fact that you have all this physical therapy and all this time at home? But is there anything that's different for you about daily living?
Right now, I'm just trying to recover and get back to normal. Once that happens, you know, then I think my lifestyle will change. I was overweight or obese prior to this, and so my goals are going to be to exercise more, eat healthier, and kind of change my lifestyle.
Yeah. Do you know anything yet about what the long-term impacts of this might be on your health?
This disease clearly affected my lungs, but it also affected other parts. So in the treatment of ARDS, I talked about diuresing the patient and trying to get as much fluid off. And during that process, very frequently the kidneys get injured. So right now I'm dealing with acute tubular necrosis or ATN, and I'm in the healing stages of it, but I'm still recovering. My kidneys are still not 100%. Hopefully they will get there, but no one knows and no one can tell if my kidneys will recover all the way. So I might have some permanent kidney damage. Also, because of my prolonged hospitalization and me being bedbound and paralyzed, I lost over 30 pounds. Most of that was muscle mass. And I talked about being deconditioned and getting winded very easily, but my heart is affected as well. Because of that deconditioning, I have a very high heart rate and high blood pressure, which I'm on high doses of medications to control that. And I'm hoping that with time, once I become more conditioned and able to walk longer and be more physically fit and regain my muscle mass, I will be able to come off those medicines. But once again, no one really knows if I will or not. COVID-19 also causes blood clots, and currently I'm being anticoagulated because I have 6 blood clots in my legs. Because of my findings, some of my colleagues started anticoagulating their COVID patients early in the process before they even found any sort of blood clots. And that has shown significant success in treating those patients. So it's not, you know, COVID-19 isn't just a respiratory disease or a lung disease. It affects multiple organs, multiple systems in your body, and it's deadly. I mean, as we've seen.
There is so much to keep on thinking about, even after recovering from the disease. Eugene, we really wish you the best in your recovery, and we want to thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Eugene Vovchuk, an anesthesiologist at DMC Harper in Detroit and a survivor of the new coronavirus. We're looking forward to bringing you more stories of those who survived and those who have not in the weeks to come. If you have a story to share, please email us, stateside@michiganradio.org. Blooms of cyanobacteria are a major hazard to the Lake Erie ecosystem. They produce a toxin that can be deadly to animals and toxic to humans who swim in or drink contaminated water. The mass of microorganisms are often referred to as harmful algal blooms, even though they aren't technically algae. As is often the case in environmental matters, outcomes in one state can depend on what happens somewhere else. In the run-up to the COVID-19 outbreak, Ohio made a key breakthrough for fighting cyanobacteria in Lake Erie. But like so many other things, that's now in question. Andy Chow is a reporter for Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau, and he's here to tell us more. Andy, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Andy, Ohio was on board with a plan that absolutely relieved an awful lot of environmental advocates and state government officials in Michigan and elsewhere. It's called H2Ohio. And I understand it was intended to reduce the amount of farm runoff that was entering Lake Erie and providing phosphorus to feed the algae blooms, right?
Yeah, so H2 Ohio was a plan in place to address what's become a really big issue in Ohio, as I'm sure it's been a big issue in other states too, like Michigan. But in Ohio, it really became a political battle where lawmakers would square off on how to exactly approach the idea of regulating the agriculture industry, which is, of course, the biggest industry in Ohio, but how to create regulations to allow or to be able to urge the idea of nutrient runoff. Because, you know, like you said, the algal blooms have become a really big issue in Lake Erie. About 5 years ago, it became such a big issue that it impacted the drinking water in the Toledo area. And so what happened was the governor came in. It was his first year in his term for governor. And he said, listen, this is what I want to do. I want to create a special fund that not only works to mitigate nutrient runoff right now, but creates a fund that builds up money for the future. So it was supposed to be a 10-year plan to pump about $900 million into a program that kept Lake Erie clean. After negotiating and some battles back and forth between the governor, who's a Republican, and the Republican majority in the House and Senate, they ended up with a plan to fund the program for 2 years at about $170 million.
Wow. So that's why this was considered such a Herculean accomplishment, $172 million for 2 years. Can you explain how the money would have been spent in the agriculture community?
Sure. So the big uphill battle here was the tension between environmental regulations and the agriculture industry. And what this pot of money did was say, hey, listen, we understand that U.S. farmers are having issues when it comes to creating mitigations for nutrient runoff. Why don't we as the state sort of pump some money into it? So that money became sort of a gesture from the state to say, listen, we need you to follow these nutrient management runoff issues. And so the agriculture industry seemed to weigh in heavily and say that this was something that they were into. So that money really became a big piece of the puzzle as to keeping Lake Erie clean.
Andy, it sounds like Ohio's farmers who feed into the lake through the Maumee watershed were really on board with this too.
Yeah, and I think part of the thing here kind of became a negotiation battle. So before Governor DeWine came in, former Governor John Kasich was coming in with sort of a stronger rhetoric against the agriculture industry, sort of threatening harsher regulations. And then when Governor DeWine came in, he came in proposing a set of lighter regulations with money attached. And I think that's sort of the bargaining chip that brought the agriculture business to the table. I think it looked like a better deal to them than deals from the past governor.
So how did COVID take the steam out of this plan?
So right now, as with every other element of state government, COVID-19 is also impacting this H2 Ohio plan. What the governor has said broadly is that he's wanting the state, all of his agencies, including the EPA and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and the Ohio Department of Agriculture, three agencies that impact the H2 Ohio plan, he's wanting all the state agencies to look at their budgets and try to find a way to cut at least 20% out of every single budget. And that's what puts this plan up in the air right now. Like you said, and like we mentioned before, this plan had $172 million in a pot for 2 years. That's for this year, 2020, and then for next year, 2021. But with everything up in the air as far as budget cuts go, the agencies aren't quite sure if that money's still going to be there.
Didn't the state also pledge to develop a set of guidelines for how much phosphorus could be released, a total maximum daily load, I think the term of art is? I mean, might that not still be maintained just as a way of measuring what's going on with the problem?
Yeah, so that's one of the big questions here is that the state is making a commitment to really make sure that they reduce the maximum load that's dumped into the Maumee watershed and the Lake Erie Basin. And can the state still keep that promise and hold to that if they have to make cuts in this program?
What do you think the prospects are of any of the funding being retained for H2 Ohio?
You know, I talked to a couple of different groups, including the Ohio Environmental Council, which is a big environmental group here in Ohio, and everybody seems to agree that things are just totally up in the air at this point. It's hard to tell exactly where the budgets are going to be in the next couple of months. We do know that the governor is asking for a 20% cut across the board, but it's unclear where that money is going to be cut and if H2Ohio is going to be something that's included in those cuts. What we do know is that H2Ohio was a pretty big centerpiece in the governor's budget proposal last year. It was among several measures that he announced in his State of the State address. So we know that it is something that he was happy about, that he was taking very seriously.
Andy Chow is a reporter and producer with Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau. Andy, thanks for the update.
Thank you.
We have just a brief update for you on that story. Since we talked to Andy, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has said that he wants to keep H2Ohio going as long as possible. He affirmed it's still a priority. He couldn't say for certain whether further cuts will be made, but the application process allowing farmers to get into the program has been cut off. After the break, alternative weekly newspapers depend on small businesses and event advertising to fund their operations.
The bread and butter of the advertising has been concerts, things to do, restaurants, bars, and that all immediately dried up when the pandemic hit.
So what do we lose when alternative papers disappear? That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's estimated that many businesses that we know and love will fail during the pandemic. Of course, we worry about the neighborhood bars, your hair salon, the small manufacturers. But there's a lot that gives our life in Michigan texture that's not really about durable goods and services, but about stories and information. This week, the Detroit Metro Times publishes a special issue, dozens of writers offering messages of hope for the pandemic. Many of these writers you've met on this show over time, Jessica Caremore, Nandi Comer, Michael Zadorian, and others. The Metro Times is offering this up, despite the fact that its own days may be numbered. Lee DeVito is editor-in-chief of the Detroit Metro Times, and Drew Philp is the writer and journalist who's guest editing this week's issue. Gentlemen, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's start out with the situation that the company finds itself in, Lee. You were recently told by the paper's parent company that you needed to lay off the entire staff except for you and one reporter. I understand you're foregoing your own salary right now.
I did, yeah. I'm happy that I think I'm going to be able to start getting paid again with the federal payroll protection program. But yeah, for March and April, I decided to forego my pay so I could keep two other members and have a staff of three, mostly because I had no idea how to do the paper without it. You know, we're continuing to press forward regardless.
There are an awful lot of alt weeklies around the country right now that just saw their ad revenues completely bottom out as live events and other chestnuts of their advertising just went by the wayside because of physical distancing. Is that pretty much what's been happening at the Metro Times?
Yeah. You know, since like 1980, when the paper first came out, the bread and butter of the advertising has been concerts, things to do, restaurants, bars. And that all immediately dried up when the pandemic hit. Honestly, right now, the majority of our ads is the marijuana dispensaries because those were deemed an essential business. But yeah, it was a huge blow to our revenue. So we are putting out a smaller version of the book, but we've still been putting it out every week.
What's it been like to try to keep operating under those circumstances?
Weird. We've all been working from home, so remotely. A lot of Zoom meetings, as I'm sure workplaces across the country and world are doing. But yeah, it's been odd to not be able to go out in the community as much, you know, or at least, you know, doing reporting from such a far distance.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do a special issue?
That was Drew. Drew, you know, I've been, you know, just kind of frantically trying to continue to put the paper out. And Drew kept bugging me. And finally, I was like, okay, what is it, Drew? What is it? And I was actually really impressed by his idea. So yeah, take it away, Drew.
Yeah, so I saw Lee working without a salary, and I knew things were pretty bad. You know, I've worked with the Metro Times as a journalist for years. I think I've been in Detroit for 13 years or something like that now. And I've read the Metro Times that whole time. I've published things in there, and it's a really important news outlet for Detroit, both for our arts community and for the city itself. I mean, one thing that people forget is that democracy is impossible without news and local news, because you need an educated, kind of up-to-date populace to make decisions about their own government. And the same is kind of true about, you know, like art scene, you know, like that's, these are like kind of the foundation building blocks of our culture. And without papers like the Metro Times, you know, how do you get the word out about, you know, shows and events, and how do you bring some of these writers and artists to larger audiences? How do you have young journalists kind of practice their craft without places like the Metro Times? So, you know, I was looking for something to do to help out in the middle of this pandemic. I could do it from home, and you know, like, it's just a small part of that. I want to stress that, you know, there are 24 artists and writers and poets from Detroit who have participated in this issue. And it's like fire, man. I mean, these are some of our best communicators in many different mediums in kind of Southeast Michigan. And it's really a record of what people are thinking and feeling during this just kind of wild portion of American history. So, you know, I think what all these artists have done is really important. And, you know, the other thing I want to stress too is they're all participating for free.
Yeah.
Everyone donated their time to give the, you know, like the Metro Times this, and the theme was hope. So there, people were really giving their best selves. I think we have some really beautiful pieces, you know, trying not to just keep the Metro Times going, but
talking about the community.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, Drew, I know you've written for publications, you know, of every size. And we've seen, I mean, I don't want to, I'll stop short of saying a resurgence of like newspaper subscriptions, but some people are, you know, agreeing right now, democracy dies in darkness, as one paper likes to put it. And yet, you know, a paper that, say, covers the Detroit hip hop and house scene, or, you know, that pays attention to local film events has not been able to keep pace.
You know, let me put it like this. So, you know, I've written for The Guardian, which is one of the largest newspapers on the planet. I wrote a book for Scribner, which is, you know, the publisher of Hemingway and one of the most respected publishers on the planet. I couldn't have done it without papers like the Metro Times. That's like where I and many other people have cut their teeth. I still, you know, like still will do things for the Metro Times like this, but it's not possible. You can't just go from, you know, writing for a college newspaper to The Guardian. I mean, some people can, but it's unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, local organizations are very important to writers as well. You have to have these kind of like, you know, AAA teams to be able to make it to the big league. So if they go away, it's you know, at least just in a decent hole in our news ecosystem.
And the engineering school, if you like, that gets you the car you'll eventually want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Drew, how did you choose the lineup of writers that are featured?
A lot of them were people I know from just being in the community. There were a handful of people that I had respected their work and known their work and kind of contacted them with, you know, my hat in my hands asking for this thing. And basically, you know, the community just really showed out in an incredible way. So a lot of times, like, I mean, Detroit's like, they call it what, the biggest small town in America. So a lot of us know each other. So basically, it was basically that. A lot of the participants are all also winners of the Kresge Arts in Detroit Fellowship.
Right.
I think there was 17 of those. So I was able to contact some people that I didn't know personally that way as well.
What kinds of messages are people bringing? I mean, Lee, do you want to give us a sense of, you know, the kinds of ways people chose to talk about hope right now?
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, which I love about it. You know, there's really small personal stories. Some, you know, where the pandemic is kind of just a background force. It's not even really at the forefront. Some stuff, you know, you don't even, you know, not explicitly about the pandemic at all. But, you know, the overall package is extremely Detroit, and it is extremely right now. And I was blown away at how quickly it came together also, which I think kind of factors in with the kind of pandemic factoring into it. Even if it's not explicit, I feel like you can still feel it. And just by virtue of it being made, you know, right now.
I have a question I'd like to ask both of you. And Lee, I think I'll ask you to answer first. Just what it means when we, you know, when we see these artists finding a way through this and finding a way to talk about the hope and community that we find in each other. What does that say about Detroit and its creative community?
I think that Detroit is its creative community. You know, like I think, you know, the arts and culture are the soul of the city. And I mean, that's why I started reading Metro Times in the first place when I was a teenager, for the art and culture coverage and Savage Love. But that was my window to Detroit. You know, it was my way of understanding Detroit. I grew up in the suburbs and in Farmington Hills. And, you know, that's what I love about it. That's what I love about the scene here, is the art scene is so connected to each other and to the city.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Lee DeVito, editor-in-chief of the Detroit Metro Times, and Drew Philp, who's guest editing a special issue this week. Drew, what do you see reflected back of Detroit in these essays?
I mean, I think Detroit's art scene is one of the best kept secrets in the world. You know, the talent in this issue is truly world class. I mean, I'm not blowing smoke when I say that some of these folks are ridiculously good writers and artists. So, you know, I think Detroit has been practicing for hope for a long time. I mean, Detroit's gone through a lot of terrible stuff and had a lot of terrible stuff done to it. And the art scene has survived through all that. And that's due to many factors. One, just the kind of quality of people we have in Detroit, but also because of some of these big organizations like the Detroit Institute of Arts have been really steady through everything and allowed this art scene to kind of flourish while things have been cheap and in many cases desperate. So I think Detroit has a lot to say to the rest of the country about what's going on, because we've had to look for the hope in this kind of grimness for so long. One of the things I like to say is that, you know, more and more and more often, the rest of America is looking like Detroit. And I think that if they're smart, they're going to look to many people here to see ways out of this. And I think that's really showcased in this issue so wonderfully.
Lee, I just wanted to say that I've been impressed. You know, I knew a little bit of what was going on behind the scenes, and I've been impressed that there's been this stream of stuff that I'm interested in and stuff that either amuses me or kind of makes me, you know, wrinkle my eyebrows a little bit all through all this. How do you decide what you can do at a time when you're in the middle of a 4-alarm fire? What kind of stories you're going to cover when there's almost no one left to cover it?
Yeah. It's been a shift for sure. I mean, like a lot, like at first, I mean, that first week of March, it was just, okay, this thing's canceled, this thing's closed, this thing's closed, this thing's closed. And much of what we were doing was just kind of reacting to that. But, you know, like, I don't know, man, it's just been what we've been doing for, you know, the past, the team here has been doing for the past few years. Part of it is like, what else are we going to do right now, you know, except just stick to what we've been, you know how to do.
What we do best.
Yeah. It's kind of all I know how to do right now.
Drew, what would you say, are there kinds of stories that you've seen in terms of news coverage that you think just might not be handled anywhere else or might not be handled with the reality check that alternative papers can sometimes provide?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, when I first really kind of, the Metro Times kind of came into my consciousness and I really understood it, they were working on a very long series. I think it was called Detroit's Big Burn, about Detroit's trash incinerator that was basically poisoning everyone on the east side in the neighborhood where I live in. They worked on that for years when very few other people were. It was very important. And that trash incinerator was just shut down last year, in part, in my belief, to the reporting of the Metro Times. So I think that stuff is going on all the time. You know, there's Detroit City Council president has just been very credibly accused in national news of, you know, what amounts to campaign violations, you know, taking bribes. I've seen very little coverage in the local news of that. You know, papers like the Metro Times jump on that stuff. Issues with the Flint water crisis and the statute of limitations running out for that. Papers like the Metro Times do stuff like that that other people just aren't covering. That's absolutely essential, you know, to our very democracy. So I think that's a huge part of why we have to keep these papers around, you know, papers like the Free Press and the News, of course, and NPR as well. Like it's all part of the same ecosystem. And I don't know if there's a ton of competition there. I don't think there should be. But it's absolutely essential that we have this diversity of perspectives, and people are looking out kind of for the spots that others are missing. And I think the Metro Times has been, perhaps the word is notorious for that, but it's been really, really important. It's been absolutely important.
Yeah, and Drew came onto my radar when he did a profile on the celebrity attorney Jemana Kairouz,
whose billboards are ubiquitous all over the metro area.
Yeah, and everyone knows his billboards, and nobody really knew the story behind her. And he did this great kind of profile on her, and that's the kind of thing that I love to see in Metro Times.
And so many, even in towns that still have a daily paper of record, those kinds of stories really have gone by the wayside as they've had financial challenges of their own.
Right.
Lee, I know things are pretty hand-to-mouth right now, but how close to the edge is it? How long do you think the paper can keep on publishing?
You know, there's a lot of X factors there. Like I said, we got some help from the small business grant from the government, which is good. But, the thing with Metro Times and all alt weeklies, all publications, things have been tough for years, like advertising has been drying up for years, going to the internet. Classifieds used to be such a source of revenue. Our own events, we've shifted to a model in recent years where Metro Times puts on, tasting events and other kinds of things. And now we can't even do those. So, like I said, I think we're fortunate because Metro Times has also long been a place for the marijuana industry to advertise. We long championed that, before the kind of rest of the mainstream caught on. So fortunate that we have those. But yeah, I personally just can't even really wrap my mind around a world that doesn't have concerts and festivals anytime soon. It's possible we might, as other publications have done, including some of our sister papers in other cities like Cleveland, might shift to every other week, Mm-hmm. We might shift to online only for a while, but we are committed and determined to hang in there. Metro Times turns 40 in October, and that's kind of my goal. I got to get us to 40.
I know that there's work of varying lengths in this special issue that's coming out this week, but is there anything, Drew, that you might be able to read to us that you're particularly proud of in this issue?
Absolutely. I can't say that I'm particularly proud of any one of these pieces because it's all such a wonderful collage, but this is our shortest poem, and it's just absolutely lovely by a great Detroit poet named Billy Mark. It's called Heal. In the shadow of human quiet, as the unforeseeable future opens like the wing of a lung, a balm as wide as the earth stretches into unaddressed places.
That's devastating.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, our work is the work this week is just all of this quality. And I really encourage you to check it on the internet or pick it up in newsstands.
I suppose we should also say this is an opportunity to find Detroit artists who we can all support at this time too.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, part of the thing is too, like the generosity that came out of this community is a lot of these people's incomes have really taken a hit because of this. Myself included. So people are not only struggling themselves, they're really digging deep to give generously. And it's a beautiful gift they've given to our community.
Lee DeVito is editor-in-chief of the Detroit Metro Times. We've also been talking with Drew Philp, who's guest editing this week's special issue, Stories of Hope, as everyone tries to get through what's happening on every level right now. Guys, thank you so much for talking with us. And I've been saying this so often, but good luck.
Thank you. You too.
That's Stateside for today. Producers are Laura Weber-Davis, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Mike Blank. They get help from our interns Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.